FBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Roth.
Ahoy, friends, and thank you for tuning in to Truth and Justice. I am back this week, and you are listening to the Friday follow-up for Season 12, Episode 41, End of the Rainbow. This week, we heard Bob break down the second half of LeClaire's trial transcripts. We dove headfirst into dissecting the footprints, as well as the wheelbarrow tracks. This episode I've been waiting for, and today, I'm joined by Bob and Janet, and we are going to dive into your listener questions right after this break.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications, and that's why yesterday I knew that you did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just say you're sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Say goodbye to the dish and hello to Sky Stream, the new way to get Sky over Wi-Fi. So you can get unmissable Sky shows like The Last of Us and Succession, as well as Netflix and Discovery Plus, and loads more, all in one subscription for £26 a month. Oh, and next day delivery with no upfront fee. Sky Stream, TV simplified. Head to sky.com. Requires Sky Stream and broadband minimum speed 10 megabits per second, 18-month minimum term. Cut-off times apply for next day delivery. Excludes bank holiday. 18 plus terms apply.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. As I'm sure Zach mentioned, that he's here.
And, I am here. I'm back.
No longer on assignment this week. Janet's here. Real quick, before we get into this week's episode and questions, Janet reminded me during the, well, the two of them reminded me during the Patreon pre-show that we have a new TV show coming out yesterday when you're listening to this that I forgot to say anything about. When you're listening this Friday, yesterday, the 19th of January, on Hulu, a new series is coming out called Web of Death. The premise behind the series are each episode covers a case where, air quotes, internet sleuths helped to accomplish something in our criminal justice system. And episode 3 is going to be about our season 2, which is Ed 8's case in the murder of Elnora Griffin. I think the way Hulu releases their episodes, I think their Netflix is the one that puts them all out at once, right?
Correct.
Yeah. So our episode won't be out this week. I think it'll be out in a couple of weeks. But Web of Death, the series premieres last night. So if you have Hulu, get on there and check it out. And I'll let you know, hopefully, if I remember when our episode comes out. But I'm super excited to see it. I've been wanting, as a matter of fact, my TV show, the docuseries, was originally, we pitched it to be Ed's case, and the network said they liked it, but they thought it would take too long to get a resolution, and then 6 months, so they passed on it, and then 6 months later, Ed got out of prison, and we ended up doing the West Memphis 3, but I've been wanting to, that was what originally got me even interested in doing a TV series, was not because I ever wanted to be on TV. It was because I wanted to get Ed's story out for a broader audience to hear. And so I turned down a lot of interviews for stuff like this. But when they came to me and said they wanted to do it on Ed's case, I said, bring it on. Let's do it. And so we filmed this. We decided it was while you were last spring. You were here.
Yeah. Yeah. It was definitely happening.
Yep. When they filmed it, and it's coming out now. So. And Nicole in the YouTube says she'll use her free month of Hulu just to watch this. That's awesome. And so, yeah, apparently if Hulu gives you a free month, there you go. You can watch it for free. So it's called Web of Death, comes out on January 19th, which means my episode will probably air first week of February, like February 2nd, I'm guessing. But, cool. But I think Hulu sometimes drops two episodes. As you can tell, I don't really know what's going on. all I know is that it premieres on Thursday night. For all I know, all four episodes are coming out Thursday.
Sounds like people might have to do a little web sleuthing of their own. Thanks, Bob.
All right. Merch. A lot of people have been emailing me about merch. A lot of you probably already have it. We were promised that it would get shipped out the week of the 9th. So Saturday, I reached out to the manufacturer and asked her, how's it going? And she said that all domestic orders shipped out on Friday, last Friday, a week ago. So by the time you're hearing this, you should have your stuff if you live in the United States. And this week, they were shipping out the international orders. So anybody overseas should be getting them sometime soon. When you get your merch, make sure you put some pictures on social media and tag us so we can retweet you and stuff like that.
Hey, my web sleuthing tells me all six episodes are coming out on the same day.
Really? Oh, and there's six?
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I thought there was four. So yep. All the entire series drops Thursday.
That's what it says.
Oh, okay. There you go. Well, episode three is about Ed's case. And Ed and Kim and I think his kids participated in it. They're going to be in it. Allison Clayton from the Innocence Project is in it. I think Roger Nichols is in it. Very cool. Myself, good old Mike is in it.
You know who's not in it?
Zach. Zach is not in it. My dad might be in it. And I learned that there's a certain personality trait that has passed down from my father all the way to my son. Because they interviewed my dad, and they had me sitting in there for part of his interview. And I don't know if this is going to make the cut, but when you see my dad's interview, just know that half of what he's saying, at least half, is total bullshit. And I'm wondering how they cut it, because there was one point said, he's like, he's telling this story about how he's like, yeah, back when old Bobby was 10 years old, you know, he said, I don't know, I don't know what the fuck, it was something about baseball or something, and he said, I can't do it, Dad. And I told him, whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. And they were like, oh, wow. And I was like, that's bullshit. That was a phrase I used to use. Great. And I think it's from George Washington. I would use that quote when I was teaching physical conditioning at the fire department. That's something you said to me when I was 10.
Goes down the generations, because your credibility is already precarious at best. So you have not helped yourself at all.
Oh, I was like trying to, and I couldn't, because
can't wait.
You know me, I'm sitting there like, you can't tell lies in this because it's, God damn it. And maybe that's the way he remembered it going down. But then at night, they wanted to film just a family dinner, which if you've ever been to a rough family dinner at our house, they're a good time. Like, one thing we've accomplished over the years is that our teenagers, because we have a 22-year-old that's out of the house, but we have a senior and a junior, and then my son Parker, who is in sixth grade. But the senior and junior love family dinner. They can't wait to sit down to dinner. They love bringing friends to come to family dinner. That's because lovely. It's not the Cleavers. I mean, we sit there and just make fun of each other the whole time. And so they, first of all, they tricked Becky, because Becky's like, I don't want to be on camera. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, don't worry, you won't be. And then right before dinner, they're like, let me just put this microphone on you. Mm-hmm. And then they filmed her. So she's upset about
this
that.
This is exciting.
Yeah, here's a little, this is how the sausage is made when you watch the show.
Mm-hmm.
But then they started talking to Quentin, my oldest. And he got himself caught in a bit of a lie early in the day.
Oh, no.
And I don't know how this is going to play out either. I'm just getting ahead of all this.
Good.
So I had mentioned to the producers that Quentin has made me into a meme at his school, because he always, like, if you call him on his cell phone, his voicemail says, this is Quentin Ruff, son of Bob Ruff of the Truth and Justice podcast. And so it got to the point where all like his English teacher told me, they're like, we just did speeches this week, and every single person somehow mentioned Bob Ruff of the Truth and Justice podcast in their speech. There's a big joke that Quentin has created.
That's great.
The producers are British. There's a bit of a language gap. They didn't understand what I meant by he made me into a meme. Uh-huh. And so Quentin comes home from school and they're like, oh, I hear you make a lot of memes of your dad. And he's like, huh? Yeah. What? I do. And my daughter's there too.
Oh, no.
And they're like, yeah, what kind of meme? And they're like, we would love to put some of these memes on the show. Can you show us some? And of course, there are no memes. He's never made a meme.
Yeah.
So then he and Bella go downstairs on his computer and very quickly start making memes of like pictures of me.
Oh, no.
And then at dinner, they start talking to him about it. And I don't remember what happened. All I know is they pointed a camera at him, asked him a question. And when he was done answering, they kept the camera on him. And so he just kept talking.
Yeah.
And talking.
False confession.
And talking. Mm-hmm. And every time there was an uncomfortable silence, he kept talking.
Yeah.
And he was, none of it's true. He was, it was just like, just nonsense. No. He was rambling on about to the point when dinner was over and the crew finally left. He was freaking out. He's like, what? I don't know what happened. He's like, something happened to my brain because of the meme thing. And then my brain was like, oh, we lying now. So then I just kept making, so
I cannot believe this.
I just, so you know, when you guys see the show, if you see my son or my father telling stories about me, none of it's true.
Great.
Because they were all like, Quentin's like, yeah, I remember being in the car and my dad telling me that, you know, I'm going to get this guy out of jail, Quentin. Never happened. Never. didn't happen. None of that ever.
You know what did happen is we started recording 32 plus minutes ago.
Yeah. Oh.
And yeah. You have been telling like a story about the Hulu show. Sounds like a Patreon. Wait.
Yeah. And there is like your little Patreon preview story of what you would get if you were a patron and you.
But often better watched. Because we're also talking.
It's not just me.
So don't feel dissuaded from joining the Patreon.
Okay. So, yeah. Anyway, that is that's me, like, literally in this moment when he brought that up on his screen, suddenly all that those memories
came rushing back.
Came rushing back, and I had a panic attack. That's why I just rambled for those 5 minutes. Sorry
you
about
pulled
that.
A, we call that pulling a Quentin. Right. You except literally did what you were describing he was doing. So that checks out.
So, that being said, Kelly, this seems like a good time for an ad break to cleanse everybody's palate, and then we'll get right back into the show.
And we're back. We have a lot to talk about. We are talking about the episode titled The End of the Rainbow, which I don't know if you felt this way, Zap, but before you know why it's called that, there's definitely a moment of like, is this the weirdest title we've ever had for a Truth and Justice episode? And it may be.
Yeah, I was... When I downloaded it on Sunday, I was a little alarmed. I didn't know what this meant. I didn't know if this was like, oh, we're done.
So tell me, though, because I take pride in the names of the episodes. I mean, a lot of times just like LeClaire's Testimony, but I was pretty happy with that title. Was there a point in the episode where you were like, oh, I get it?
Yes, but I think it might serve people if you revisit, because you very quickly say why it's called that at the top, and I think it might have slipped past some people. Many people it didn't, but will you just revisit with us why it's called that?
Oh, it's because in LeClaire's, on his hand-drawn map that he drew of the wheelbarrow track, he wrote on there, End of the Rainbow, where he found the business card.
And that's strange.
Yeah, it is strange, but it worked out well for me as a writer because then I got to close the episode with, the business card is no pot of gold, which I thought was some of my best work.
It's clever. Yeah. It was clever.
Good stuff. It's no Liar Liar Pants on Fire, but it's good stuff. Now,
yeah. That was my best line ever.
I guess my question about that is he wrote that then, like he wrote that back at the time as if there was something more meaningful to it, because we keep having this conversation where we're going back and forth as to whether or not he felt that was actually important. And so it's an interesting thing to write if when you find it, you think it's meaningful.
Yeah. It's also not written like by the spot on the drawing where the business card is. It's just like written at the top. There's like a note, a random note he wrote was End of the Rainbow. And then in his testimony, I think it was Moore asked him, like, what did you mean by that? And he was just like, it just meant the end of the track, like where the, like he's very, I wish we had audio of his testimony, because the way I read his audio was like very, even during direct, like dismissive. Like he wasn't, he definitely, I will say this about LeClaire, he definitely is not one of the people that we see, because oftentimes we see where like the investigator or somebody that's on like team prosecution will be bending things and twisting things to try to help the case. I did not get that impression from LeClaire at all. And when you read the testimony, you'll see what I'm talking about. He's pretty direct and honest, I think. I mean, he just, you know, like when Dolan's asking him, you know, if the business card is important. He's like, I don't know. He's like, is it just a theory? He's like, yeah. And he's like, so maybe it's not important. He's like, might not be important at all. Like, he's just very open about that during his testimony.
But you also say at times that you feel like I think this happened in the episode prior to this more than in this episode, that you feel perhaps like when he says, I don't know, that's like, maybe they wanted him to say something else that wasn't accurate. And he was like, I'll say, I don't know, but I'm not going to say. I mean,
it could be
totally speculating. I'm completely wildly speculating.
I hate that when I see it, and oftentimes that's what it seems like, is that because there are definitely times when they ask questions. I'm struggling to think of an example right off the top of my head, but where they'll ask a question where, like, we know the answer to that. Mm-hmm. Okay, so didn't they find DNA on the socks that didn't match them? And he's like, I don't recall.
Right.
And it makes it so you can't, because of the rules of testimony, they can't be like, what do you mean you don't know? You don't know that. And then they'll object and say, asked and answered. And that's, so they have to move on from it. But, you know, and it could be that all happened after he was gone too, after he wasn't on the case anymore. So it could be that he genuinely didn't know. I don't know. But it was just frustrating because there were the points that came up that would have been helpful for the defense. There were oftentimes where he would just say, I don't know, or I don't recall.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, like we can only speculate that that's what it could mean. And that's maybe not fair to him, but okay. So we have a lot of questions, but I would love to hear, Zach, from you, what your thoughts were on the episode.
I'm really excited that we moved into some more physical evidence. The trial testimony is interesting, but like when Bob really started to break down like the footprints and breaking down the photos next to each other, that's what really intrigues me. That's always been what brings me into these cases the most, is actually seeing the physical evidence. And I have the pictures pulled up right here. And as Bob was talking about, I mean, it's clear what he's breaking down the episode as far as the dry soil, the wet soil, the tire tracks. I mean, there's a lot there, and I'm sure there's a ton of listener questions about it. So I don't want to go over it too much, but that was huge for me. And I'm so happy he brought this into the forefront.
Well, real quickly, cause I haven't asked you this, and I think the listeners know and trust you enough, know that you have no problem being the contrarian in the room. If you disagree with me, you're looking at the photo. What are your thoughts on the soil conditions between the video in 2017 and the original footprint?
Well, I mean, clearly I'm looking at the side-by-side photo that's pulled up on the website, so everybody can see the same photo that I'm looking at. It's very obvious that this soil, where the footprint is from original, was wet or damp because it's compressed. You can see that it's compressed in that nature. I mean, it has to be damp or wet. There are cracks along the edges, which to me appears that it's dried and separated on its own, which I don't think happens, you know, that wouldn't happen in a sandy soil like that if it wasn't. Right. I mean, think about walking down the beach. You know what I mean? If you're walking literally on the water line, those tracks are harsh. And as you get into the sand, I mean, they change.
Yeah.
That's a great comparison. Where was that in the episode?
So, I mean, that's exactly what you're seeing here, in my opinion. Now, there are some tracks in some of the other photos kind of looking that maybe have a soft edge, so it's hard to tell. I mean, this particular track obviously has a hard edge, and I think everybody can see that. Some of the other evidence photos they took of the globe and the vans, some of them do appear to have a soft edge, so it could be that it's a softer soil, that it's a drier soil. It could be that it was protected by brush or something, and that's why it didn't blow away. But that's what I see.
Yeah, and so my feelings on that are, so the tracks are supposed to be all made at the same time, but because of the broken nature of the track and the wheel track, is that, you know, like what we experienced out there, Janet, and we saw, there's areas where the washout will find the low area and go through. And I think the track went, you know, in and out of that. They didn't stay in a washout area the whole time. So when they're down in the washout area where it's still wet, you get tracks like that. And then areas where they're outside of it, they're far less defined.
Right.
And that one, the exhibit 140, is the best because they're trying to get both prints. So they take a nice, clear, straight down close up. So we get to really look at the soil condition in that one.
Yeah. Well, Bob in the chat says, you know, we could potentially get somebody who's a little more expert, or somebody whose actual like career is kind of analyzing that sort of thing. Do you feel like it's...
I don't know what...
It's ambiguous enough to potentially have somebody come in and do that kind of analysis on the photographs?
It'd be worth a try. I don't know what... There's probably a soil expert of some kind that we can.
Yeah, there
in.
Definitely are. There definitely are.
Yeah, I'll do some looking at that. If we can find someone, we'll for sure bring them out and have them break it down.
I mean, I know I said it earlier, but I mean, literally looking at these two photos side by side, that's immediately what I think about is a beach, is just walking down a beach.
That was great. When you're talking about when you step close to shore where the sand's wet compared to out where it's dry, That's a great, I agree with Jana. That's a great example of the difference between the two.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's get into some stuff from our wonderful listeners. So Autumn was one of the folks, and I know this came up last week as well, who thought that for whatever, however we described our experience being up there, there was a couple of people thought that we had said that we ourselves saw the hole. I don't ever remember us saying that. That No. doesn't mean that we maybe said something that you know, got conflated with our conversation about the photos of the hole with the tree roots. So she sort of sprung off of that saying she had been under the impression that was the case. And I did answer that in the follow-up on Facebook. I went ahead and answered that piece of it. But she says, there are a lot of theories stated as fact this week. Can we get some clarification on what the newly established evidence is? So as just sort of an overview, thinking back on the episode that you just did, mm-hmm. how are you feeling about like anything crisp that you want to sort of clarify? Like, we officially feel like we now think this about the wheelbarrow tracks or whatever.
Well, this is my feeling. And it all comes down to, is the business card a part of this crime? Which, in order for it to be a part of the crime, then the wheelbarrow track and footprints have to be a part of the crime, right? So like if you found a business card 300 yards away from a crime scene, just out in the desert somewhere, upwind of the crime scene, no less, mm-hmm. you would not give it a second thought. The only reason it was thought to be maybe part of it is because there's a track there, you know, the body's in the wheelbarrow, it's wheelbarrow tracks that lead to it. So I look at it like this, despite all the issues with the card, right? Like the fact, like the DNA, the state's own expert says that it shows the type of degradation you'd expect if something was outside in the weather for a year. So besides those issues with it, the card, we've learned, is not actually connected to the track. It is 60 feet by estimated 60 feet from the last point of human activity, again, upwind. Right. So you cannot say that the card is connected to the end of the track. That's problem one. The track itself, as we know, knew was a broken track after really looking and examining the photos that were used at trial, that were taken of the crime scene. I have yet to find anyone who disagrees, and I'm sure there's people out there, but I have not come across anyone who disagrees that those tracks were made when the ground was wet. It had been dry for 15 days on the night of the crime, which tells me, if I'm just looking at this objectively, forget about DNA and stuff on the card, I'm just looking at the track objectively, mm-hmm. the evidence would tell me that those tracks were made sometime short, like the day after a rain. They were made when the ground was still wet, which had to have been 2 weeks before that. So that was part of it. Then we get to the other end of the track, and do the tracks connect to the wheelbarrow? And the answer there is also no. Now, can you ascertain that because there's a wheelbarrow and wheelbarrow tracks, they're connected, they're not that far away? Yes. But do they actually connect? And the answer is no. The tracks stop. Now, LeClaire says 25 feet. Since I've done the episode, I found Barrow's report. And Barrow's made a diagram where she actually showed the distance, a measured distance, from the wheelbarrow to the beginning of the track, mm-hmm. and it's 17 feet and some inches is how far it actually is actually away. So 17 feet away is where the tracks start. The tracks aren't pointing in the direction of the wheelbarrow.
Right.
There's and we can see in photos the ground between the two that should hold a track. Right. Unless the wheelbarrow was put where it was found after the rain. You know, it was there or before, you know, before there's no way. Let me restate that, because that's not accurate what I just said. The dirt that we see between the wheelbarrow and the track had to have been put there after the wheelbarrow moved from the end of the track to where mm-hmm. the wheelbarrow's at. Now, we've also seen the hole that was dug right there. We've seen what appears to be loose dirt all around that area. So the first things first is the evidence. I can't say the evidence proves that the wheelbarrow track isn't relevant to the crime scene. I think it very much indicates that. But what I can say is it certainly shows that you cannot prove that that track was made on that night, which is what has to happen for the state's case.
Yes.
In fact, in every element counters that argument.
Yes.
Or counters that theory. And my process is gather evidence, develop a theory, dig deeper into the evidence, and compare the evidence to the theory. And you find holes being shot in the theory all over the place. Every step along the way, the theory that that track was made during the commission of the crime that night.
Right.
The evidence does not support that.
Right.
So then I look at, okay, so what is my theory based on the evidence that I see? My theory is that track was made the day after, or at most maybe 2 days after a rain when the ground is still wet, but it's desert. So I would think it would probably have to be the next day because it's going to dry up quick.
It dries out quickly.
Yeah. And the evidence to me, my theory is that track was made when a tree was moved and transplanted. Mm-hmm. Now, the evidence to support that, we already have the information I just shared with you, and we have out near the end of the track is a hole where something was dug out, according to LeClaire. He dug down 2 feet into it of soft soil. So something big was dug out of the ground. We can see roots and stuff in the crime scene photos coming out of the edge. It looks very much like a tree was dug out of that area. Now, is it an issue that that tree is 60 feet away from the end of the track? It's not an issue because, as I've said, we only see the clear track where the ground was wet. If it was up on higher ground when they dug the tree out, then it's no problem at all. That because for 2 weeks, those tracks wouldn't survive the wind in the desert for 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But they would survive that night for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But if we're talking 2 weeks ago, it's not an issue. It's higher ground. It's not one of, we can see in the photos, it's not in one of the washout areas.
Yeah.
So that area wouldn't still be wet. So we have a hole with roots on it that supports the theory that a tree was moved. You've got the wheelbarrow tracks that go all the way up. And then the wheelbarrow tracks stop 6 feet away from where we see a freshly transplanted tree.
Right.
So that also supports the theory. And then to counter, again, what I forgot here in the first round, to counter the theory that the wheelbarrow was used to move Becky's body on that night is the dirt that we see clumped on the inside of the wheelbarrow.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe that would survive if she's in there dead, which means her body's limp and easy and moving around. It was bumped along that, and again, we saw that terrain, was bumped along that terrain with her head kind of bouncing back and forth. I don't think there's any way that that clumped on dirt would remain on the wheelbarrow. But if we use that, if we take that clumped on dirt and compare that to the theory of it was used to move a tree
mm-hmm.
the day after a rain, you would expect that the ground was wet deep down where they dug the tree out and up by the house where they dug the hole to put the tree in. And it would have clumped on there when the ground was wet, which further supports the fact that that track was made when it was wet.
Right.
So, of course, there are people that are on they're insisting that Robert and Christian are guilty, and therefore the card has to be a part of this. That will just say that's nonsense. I've seen somebody made a post accidentally on our page that was meant for somewhere else this week that says like, well, he, you know, Bob just dismisses the business card as though I just like out of a hat just decided. It's dismissive. I've explained in detail, point by point, based on the actual evidence we see, the reasons why. Could I be wrong? Sure, I can be wrong. But I feel very comfortable that it is a legitimate reason to come to this conclusion based on what we see in the case file.
We have spent a tremendous amount of time talking about it. So I absolutely cannot agree that you just dismiss something out of hand. I think, again, the difficult thing about situations like this where there is something that in retrospect you're looking at and trying to prove means nothing, you have to give it so much air to prove that it means nothing. So it's almost counterproductive because mm-hmm. the more you talk about how something doesn't matter, the more someone who wants it to matter makes it matter. Do you know what I mean? So it's hard. It's a hard position to be in when you're trying to prove something that was never disproven, but was still used as proof for something else. If that makes sense. And so that's hard, because the more we talk about it, I think the more people who want to believe they're guilty are like, again, we're talking so much about the business card that Bob is dismissing out of hand, but we are talking about it so much that it clearly does mean something. Like, do you know what I mean? I think there's, you can get caught in a loop there.
Yeah. And to be clear, you know, it wasn't like I was trying to disprove it. My purpose in it was, this is the one linchpin of the state's case, the only physical evidence that connects either of the two to this crime scene. And so I want to see, what does the actual evidence show?
Right.
Now, if it was like, if all the evidence shows like, hey, that track was made that night.
Right.
Then that's the conclusion we would come to. But that's not it. And there's certainly more there. I mean, offhand from the beginning of this, the idea that that would be the MO here is to kill someone way out in the desert and come back and get the wheelbarrow and then go back and get the body and then take it and park it right there has never made sense.
Right.
It makes, but I can't argue that doesn't make sense. I'm not Colleen Barnett.
Right. Well, some people, I saw someone on Facebook said, I've always assumed that the wheelbarrow was already out there. And so it was just convenient that the struggle, which no one could find any sign of, happened. And then the wheelbarrow happened to be there, and then they happened to be able to use it. And somehow the ground was wet that night, even though it couldn't have been.
Yeah. And even if that's the case, why? And again, we can't base a conclusion on that doesn't make sense. But even if that's the case, why bring her body all the way back, not put it in the house, and then kill her parent, her mom and John, and light the house on fire, not put, like, it's very difficult. You have to go through so many mental gymnastics to make a reason for that to happen. It's just completely out there. And then again, you add, like, what evidence is there that there was a struggle out there?
Right.
Zero. Right. What evidence is there? There's blood out there. Zero. There's no evidence, period, that indicates that Becky was killed out there. There just isn't any. And you can't make up any. There's no, I'm repeating myself, I'm going to do it again. There is no evidence that Becky was killed out in that desert. It is nothing more than a theory based on that track. It's a reverse engineered theory based on that track. And then again, you have the more issues, like how many, like the idea of the wheelbarrow just being out there because people just keep their wheelbarrow out in the middle of public land out there somewhere is nonsense. But even if, so assuming that's not the case, you've got the trip out with at least Robert and Becky. Mm-hmm. Becky's killed, because I think one of the state's theories is that Christian was waiting in the car during the hike, which also was. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was one of the theories. And I might have been in closing or an open. I don't remember. Or it may have just been a theory that was tossed out there. But like, yeah, I'll ride up there and sit in the car for an hour while you go on a hike. Like, not likely. But if that's the case, you have two sets of tracks with Robert and Becky walking on wherever their hike went that ends at that point and then kills her in a struggle with no evidence of that. Mm-hmm. And then at least his tracks coming back and then him and Christian both walking back out there again. And then him and Christian with the wheelbarrow, then him and Christian again, walking back with the wheelbarrow. There should be it should look like what you see in that video. Right. From 2017. That's what it looks like when people are going back and forth out there in the desert. There's tracks everywhere. Right. Not just a couple that we see.
Yeah.
I don't really know exactly how to specifically say when you're talking about what is the new evidence. It's none of it's new. It's just an analysis of the evidence that has always existed, minus the prosecution spin that is she's in a wheelbarrow and there's a track that leads from the wheelbarrow to the business card. Case closed. When in fact, the track isn't connected to the wheelbarrow, the card isn't connected to the track, you know, and I'm not going to restate all that stuff all over again.
Right. Yeah. Please don't. Yeah. I would just say, I think my sense sometimes from reading Facebook is that there are two to three things that people are stuck on. And I totally get it. I get it because I feel like I was there a long time ago before I knew everything that I feel like I know now, or that I feel very, very confident that I know and understand now. I understand it's a difference of opinion. I think that people hate the fact that they were supposed to, quote unquote, supposed to be up there that night. We can't prove that they weren't, in terms of Becky didn't say he canceled and the business card. I think Christian was supposed to be there and there's a business card with his DNA. My sense is that's enough, and you have to start doing the mental gymnastics. Now, I could be wrong, and there are, and then the cell phone thing, people feeling like their phones were off, that means mm-hmm. something that's significant. I think those are the three points that I see coming up over and over again. Like, how unlucky could he be?
Yeah.
He said he was never up there, but he was clearly up there. That was clearly his business, you know, his prints, and he clearly must have been up there that night, and the hike must have taken place because if we heard a hike was supposed to take place, then we have no evidence that it didn't, then there you go. And then everything else, maybe they don't care anymore about whether the track has anything to do with it, because they're like, all I need to know is that Christian said he'd never been there and there was a thing with his DNA on it. Case closed. We can reverse engineer from there.
Yeah. And don't get me wrong. Those are legitimate concerns. Like that's, this case never would have happened against them if those circumstances didn't exist. Right. Certainly. Yeah. He says he's never there. There's a card there that has his DNA on it. And yeah, they had planned a hike that they say they canceled and no one can confirm they canceled. They can't confirm, or they maybe could have, but the police never confirmed where they were maybe at instead.
Right.
And there's no cell phone coverage up there and their phones weren't working. Like those three things definitely are cause for concern, but that's then why we do what we're doing.
Right.
Just to see like, okay, that is the broad picture. And I made the comparison to like Adnan's case before. You have extremely similar circumstances in his case where he had asked for a ride and she's killed right after school when driving. And then the cell phone seems to put him where he was based on Jay's testimony when the body, you know, it's the same thing. But then we have to look at the evidence and see. And as I've always said, if they got the right person, when you start putting a microscope on the state's case, the case will get stronger. When you put a microscope on the case and the closer you look, the less sure you are. If you're being objective, there's a good chance that they made a mistake or they just forced something to fit that didn't really fit in reality.
I just noticed Amy in the chat says, in one of the crime scene photos, there's a little red wagon on its side right in front of the wheelbarrow. Is there any mention of that in the reports? To me, that's more of a sign of a struggle. Thought that was interesting.
I haven't noticed that, Amy, but I will take a look at that. I feel like I remember seeing the wagon, but I never kind of put those together.
Okay, so let's look at that and report back. Okay, let's talk about the video for a second. Anna says, how was a videotape of the crime scene made 10 years later actual evidence at trial? And I would add, was it? Because I'm not clear if that was used in any way. Okay. So Anna's saying, I hope it was. Essentially, I hope it wasn't, because there's no way to verify that location. And then Teresa, this is more of a big picture thing, but Teresa was just kind of saying, you know, is there anything that can be done to change the practice of taping over surveillance video, or at least preserving it for a period of time after a crime? You know, who knows how many red light cameras or other businesses that could have put them there. But, and that's an interesting idea that, you know, it must be, it's hard. It's hard to, you know.
It's a storage issue. I mean, you only have so much hard drive space, or, you know, and it was there for plenty of time.
Well, yeah.
Robert told them on Monday that he was there the night before, and they preserved the video for mm-hmm. 7 days.
And what time did they say they were there?
They didn't really give a time. I don't remember if he said a time, but, you know, remember that interview. And again, this is, and certainly people will disagree with this, but what I'm hearing is interview. I'm hearing that it sounds to me as though he doesn't, one, know he's a suspect. Two, he doesn't know what time he needs to be alibiing himself for. And three, that he doesn't know or hadn't thought of the fact that his phone could be used to clear things up. He's just kind of just talking through kind of a generality. But he says that they were out, they were doing the paintball thing, and then his cousin got a hold of him. They went to the AMPM, and then he went home.
Right.
And so, again, they could have checked his texts and see what time that text came through. They could have checked the surveillance camera. So we don't know. And they never know. I see a lot in the Facebook page, like, well, why didn't they? Somebody, I just had a conversation last night on Facebook where somebody said, well, it's ridiculous that the police never talked to Christian's aunt, who he said he wasn't sure, but he thinks she was home, or wasn't sure if she was home that night, who could confirm anything. And then somebody was like, well, it's also crazy that the defense didn't ask the aunt. What you fail to realize is these guys didn't know they were suspects or when they needed to be alibied for 10 years.
Well, so didn't they? They could have known a year later when someone came with a warrant. I mean, that's a year later. That's still a huge problem. But yeah.
Yeah. So, but even then, they didn't know times, right?
Right.
They didn't know the cell phone issues. All they knew was they got interviewed and they heard nothing else. As far as they know, it's over. They move on with their lives. Right. A year later, in 2007 in the fall, the police serve warrants and go to their house and search stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they don't hear anything after that. And then how many years? 7 more years go on.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden they're arrested. So at that point, asking, so what you're talking about there, and particularly like Christian's aunt, is saying, hey, there was a night 8 years ago where the two teenage boys that are always in and out of your house, we want to know what time they were there or if they were there that night. That there's no way, even if she was like, oh, I remember, and they were home at 9 o'clock.
Right.
Well, no one would, like, that wouldn't be reliable testimony.
Right.
You know, it's useless at that point. Even a year later, remember, right, they're teenagers that are like going to work and going home and hanging out with each other at each other's house all the time.
Right.
So even a year later, it's crazy. But it's not like when they served the warrant, they said, hey, we have a warrant to search your house because we think that at 9:30 p.m. you were up the hill murdering someone and we think you left at 9:46 and you didn't get back to here. You know, they didn't have that information. They just knew that they were searching their house.
Okay. And how many times did Robert talk to police within that first year before the warrant was served, you know? Because we've only heard one interview from Robert, and we've only heard part of a transcript. You know, we've heard your characterization of the interview with Christian since we don't have the audio.
Yeah, and the transcript up on the the website. Yeah. I think Robert was, because we're going to get, obviously we're doing the case against them now. So, but I think he was interviewed again, I want to say in January of 2007, I think, and then, or maybe in October. I have to go back through, but I think they were both interviewed another time.
Okay.
Like within a year of the crime.
Yeah. Okay. Because there's conversations happening about that too. Yeah. I think there's a concern or an implication that perhaps you are planning on not covering some of that. And I know, like, for example, Kate in the chat is saying, you know, how do we look at the entire case with a microscope if we don't know the entire case against Robert and Christian? Well, we're getting there.
Yeah, you will.
Let me put it this way. Let me ask you this. Let me just ask you it this way. Bob, are you going to hide things from us to protect Robert and Christian? Are you going to hide things that you think will cause the public to damn them? Are you going to conceal those things from us, Bob?
No.
Okay.
Of course not. And nor have I ever done anything like that.
Great. Okay. Asked and answered. We will move on. And I'm sure we'll get into all that. Mm-hmm. Footprints. Tony, with all this being said about footprints, Tony reminds us, am I remembering correctly that none of these footprints were linked to Robert and Christian in any kind of meaningful way anyway?
Yeah, it's exactly right. Yeah.
Thank you.
They were matched to Robert and Christian because they, one or both of them, owned a pair of Vans.
Yeah, that's not a match.
And not only was it just like, not like we don't, like we know that it wasn't that pair of Vans. It was a different pattern on the bottom. It was just Vans.
Okay.
Kate, in the chat, I was not saying that was you. Look on Facebook. You will know what I'm talking about. Let's move on.
So as we've been sitting here talking, I've been digging through a lot of these photos, trying to look at them. There's a lot of things that strike me that I would really love to have somebody that knows what they're looking at look at these. Because if you look at all these photos of the footprints that they've taken photos of, there's no heel or toe impressions on any of them. I think there, People's 140, there's a toe impression. But
yeah,
all the rest of them have no heel and no toe impression, which leads me to believe they've been there for a while. Because if you look at the officer's tracks that are fresh, all have heel and toe impressions, which means you're moving. If you're, you know what I mean? As your foot is striking, your heel comes down first, your toe rolls up. You have a deeper heel and a deeper toe impression. There's no toe or heel impression on any of these footprints as you see them. So they, in my opinion, they have to be aged.
Also, what's that little white thing in there?
So that was brought up in trial in the same photo. On that print, I think Maura Dolan says, what is this little piece of paper trash there underneath the footprint? And somehow the question never gets answered. But it's one thing when people are like, well, there's nothing else found out there. Like in that photo.
Wouldn't you collect that as evidence?
I don't think they did. But there is like a piece of paper crumpled up, like that footprint stepped on.
Be nice to know more about that. I think, Teresa, you asked about that in the follow-up, so shout out to Teresa. That's very interesting. That's really interesting, Zach. Go you.
But if you do pull up a lot of these photos, many of them don't have heel or toe impressions on almost any of them. People's 140 seems to have a toe impression, but that seems to be the one that we look at that's really wet,
mm-hmm.
that we've kind of put up. But other than that, none of them have. And if you look at all the other ones, like where you can see the officer's prints, they all have heel and toe impressions.
Yeah, that's a good observation. I never noticed that before.
Okay.
Well, I love that you brought that up. That's really, really interesting. Okay. And speaking of the footprints, Janaya is, you know, sort of expounding on this idea of like finding out more about the footprints and never feeling like anyone got any full true clarification, even with the FBI analysis, is just, you know, wondering, how about now? Is there such a thing as an expert who could determine approximate shoe size from looking at the photos? Could Vicky's coworkers be interviewed to ask if they knew her shoe size? Could John's son be asked if he knew his dad's shoe size? Or the Roxy sandals checked? Finding out if the footprints were just John and Vicky feels pretty crucial to Janaya at this point.
Yeah, I think that it could be done. I believe, I don't remember if it was, because it was a family member that told me this. I don't remember if it was asked like at trial or like at the courthouse after his testimony. I don't think it was on the record. I don't remember the name of the person that identified the footprint, but someone asked him, you know, could he determine the size of the shoe? And he said, yes, I could, but no one asked me to. Like, the state didn't ask him to determine size, just whether that one print was a Globe footprint, which is the brand that Becky was wearing.
Right. Okay, Jason, I want to shout you out. I know you've listed this on the follow-up a couple of times, and I don't want you to feel like I'm ignoring you. Just sometimes we just don't have time. And you are very curious. You continue to ask, what is your theory on Becky's whereabouts on the night of the murder between 7:30 and 9:30? I feel like we've sort of talked about it, but maybe you're feeling more open-ended now because of new things. Or
some of what I'm going to get into in Sunday's episode. Well, I'll be talking about that on Sunday's episode. Let me say that. So I'm doing the arson investigation. To be honest with you, I kind of wish that I had just worked this stuff. I've spent all week going through it, and part of last week going through to come up where I'm at. And I didn't come up with any big rock solid answers like I was hoping to. So I'm kind of upset that's what I'm, but now I'm out of time. So that's going to be the episode.
Okay.
Is we're going to go through that stuff. But yeah, I think that again, I'll explain the details and stuff why, but I think that whoever did this, I think they got there and there was an interruption like pretty close to that time, you know, that they came to the house. I think and this is not part of Sunday's episode, so I'll share. I think they took the phone off the hook. I think because I talked to a friend who used to work for a phone company. He couldn't tell me for sure, but I told him that people kept calling that night and they kept getting a busy signal. And I wanted to know if like the phone wires melted together or they were cut, if that would cause it. And he just said he didn't think so. He said if it's a busy signal, he thinks that there would be a phone off the hook. So, but he could
like an active line somehow in more meaningful way.
Yeah, he couldn't give me anything conclusive. So, you know, one possible theory is if somebody came in and the attack began then, if all they had to do is throw the phone off the hook and that would stop, if Becky was upstairs, she wouldn't be able to call 911 or anything because the phone downstairs is off the hook.
And just very quickly, do you remember offhand, like, what time did people say that they started getting a busy signal? Do you remember? I thought it was much later, but I could be so, so wrong and have been before.
Yeah, no, I think it was Javier when he was like trying to call her at like 10 or 11 o'clock at night or something like that. I think he was the one that mentioned it. Yeah, so we don't know anything we're going to anything between 7:30 and 9:30. All we can really do is speculate about what was happening.
It's so hard.
Of course, you know, the Robert and Christian are guilty crowd will say, well, that's when she went on the hike, because there's from the last time they had phone contact, that would be it would take them about that much time to get up there. But again, I think there's other evidence indicating that something went down pretty close to then. So we'll get into more on Sunday, but just know that anything that I say about what anyone was doing during that time, because of the nature of so much evidence being destroyed in the crimes in the fire, it's just speculation.
I thought this was really interesting. Unsurprisingly, it came from Valeria. Valeria says, is there any chance that the, quote, explosion that Carissa Farley heard could have been a gunshot aimed at Becky? I think we dismissed it in the past because nobody else mentioned it, but also maybe they weren't asked, or if anyone heard it, looked out of their window and saw flames, they thought it was a noise due to the fire and didn't think it was important. I don't know if the timing works out on that, but I thought that was really interesting because there was a loud sound reported by one person. So I don't know.
Yeah, the timing is weird because she said it was like, I think she said she saw the fire was raging at that point when she heard the explosion. So the timing doesn't quite work, but it, I mean,
raging, there's also, like, she knew that, like, the fire trucks were already on their way. I can't remember
exactly, but I remember she said from her house, which is a ways away, she could see this huge fire.
Okay.
When she heard what she thought was an explosion. I don't know that anything exploded on the scene. However, there are lots of reports of a lot of ammunition popping off since then, which of course would sound like gunshots, but there were several of those. So yeah, I don't know.
Okay. Okay. I love that thinking though. Okay. So with cell phones for a moment, Sarah says, did LeClaire pull sector data for any of the phones when he pulled cell phone records?
Doesn't look like it. No.
Okay. Teresa says, when did the investigators begin to look at Robert and Christian's phone records? What date were they pulled? And what date were the other teens' phone records pulled? When and who dug into their records?
That's a good question. It was covered in LeClaire's testimony, but I don't remember the dates off the top of my head. I think that it was, but it was pretty close to, I want to say maybe October. Like, I don't think it was years later. I think it was pretty close to about that time.
Okay. Another great question from Sarah, who says, would the handling of Becky's remains and the processing of the contents of the wheelbarrow be the responsibility of LeClaire and the crime scene technicians, or would it be the responsibility of the county medical examiner / coroner? Such a great question.
So the coroner would be the one that removed the body, right? The coroner would take the body out, and I would think would take any of, like, obvious parts. Like, you can see in some of the photos where, like, she was taken out, and then you could see, like, there's, like, hair and some things that the coroner pulled out and put in there with. And to be clear, like, as far as, like, what debris was left behind, that way, if you read the transcripts, you'll see that he shows whoever was doing the cross, like, shows him the photo that I showed with the dirt clumps. It's all redacted anyway, but with the dirt clumps on there, he shows him that photo and shows him the things that are left behind in there. And then he shows him another photo that he's pointing out that same that debris is still in there, and that photo was from 3 days later when they went back. Now in that one, I can't see. I think I said, like, the ribs were still in there. I should be clear. I don't know that for sure because you can't see in that photo all. You can see there's definitely lots of debris left in there, but you can't.
God, I just can't imagine not collecting.
Yeah,
anything that's in that wheelbarrow.
Yeah, there was definitely some stuff left behind because you can see in that. Well, I mean, like hair and some stuff that was still left behind. They grabbed some of it, but as far as, like, sifting through it, that would have been the crime scene tech's job.
Okay,
like they would process it because it's not the coroner's job to find evidence, right? So the coroner would have removed her body, taken anything they think is relevant to her body, and then. The crime scene techs would then be, like, sifting, like, the coroner's not looking for bullets in the debris at the bottom. I should be clear too. I don't think, and based on the testimony, in the Claire's testimony, you know, he says he didn't do any of that. That would be Ramirez's job is what he's basically saying in his testimony. But yeah, it wouldn't have been them that moved the body out. I don't think, I think that would have been the coroner that would have done that.
Well, speaking of that, the debris that was there, Laura M. says, has it been fact-checked that her rib bones were not collected? I can't imagine LeClaire doing this recovery. Just seems an assumption has been made here. I think I might be, I mean, I'm reading that verbatim, but there might be, like, I might be confused about
it. I think she's saying it's an assumption that the bones were left
behind. Right, yeah, I just got confused about, I can't imagine LeClaire doing this recovery. It seems like it's a separate thought, but maybe I'm misunderstanding.
Yeah, no,
but
anyway,
shout out to Laura because, yeah, I mean, I think it's fair for her to say, are we sure that those are ribs? Because that's a bold statement to make about them just
there's
leaving
for
something
sure
like
ribs,
that behind.
There was for sure ribs in Exhibit GG, which was the wheelbarrow after the body was removed.
Yeah.
but I don't know if after her body was removed and they took the photos, if then they went back and pulled out a couple more things.
Like, yes,
I know there's most of the debris is still in there.
Yeah,
but because of the angle, it's I don't know if particularly the ribs were still in there.
Yeah.
So I probably shouldn't have stated that the way that I did in the way it comes across in the testimony. It sounds as though they're still there.
Yeah.
But from what I saw in the photo, I didn't see the ribs themselves. There's still plenty of debris.
We had,
it was either Bo or Nick. I think it said that, I think it was Bo that Javier told him that like her skin was still on the wheelbarrow. There's still some, like there's definitely still parts there that I think shouldn't have been left there.
But,
and there's debris left in there. But as far as if those bones were still there, and I don't remember how I stated it, but just to be clear.
I walked away feeling like you yourself identified with your own two eyes bones in the photos. And I could have completely misconstrued that.
I did.
That's, oh, okay.
And that exhibit GG, which is the wheelbarrow after they removed her body.
Yeah.
The bones are still there.
But
the next set of photos in the testimony are when they came back 3 days later and Moore's pointing out all that shit's still in there.
Okay.
But he doesn't specifically say if the bones were still in there.
Okay. Yeah, because Kristen and Nicole, I couldn't agree more with you. I had the same exact question, which is, could we be looking at different photos from different time frames of the investigation? Like, we took a picture of this version. That's where the ribs are still there. But of course, we collected the ribs. We just wanted to take a picture that they were there. And this is making people think that we didn't collect them. Like, that sort of thing where there's the timeline of when photos are taken, like, maybe, you know, could account for some of these things that we would hope would be collected and were.
To be clear, the ribs may have been collected after her body. There's still plenty of debris there.
Right.
It was never sifted through to look for evidence.
Okay.
But the ribs may have been. I don't know for sure if the ribs were taken or left. Because in the body bag where you see where they put stuff, you could tell the stuff they took from the wheelbarrow and put in there with her. I don't see those at least two, I think three ribs from the wheelbarrow. I don't see those laying there in that pile. So I don't know.
Yeah. And shout out to Bob R. I agree with you. It's hard because if, you know, family members ever listen to this, it's already so tragic and so triggering to have to, you know, hear about this stuff. And thank you for reminding me of that and the sensitivity to that. I couldn't appreciate that more, Bob. And I am not talking to you, Bob Ruff, even though this is a different Bob R. I just realized saying Bob R. did not help clarify that.
Didn't help
at all. That's on me. Really quickly, I just want to push back on something that I didn't see anything come up in the chat in the Facebook follow-up. But I wanted to, as long as we're pushing back, I just wanted to push back on the Osterlo stuff that you were talking about. I know it's not a huge thing, but, you know, I felt a little bit like you picked and choosed what you wanted about Osterlo. Like, if he's full of shit, then I don't care how far away he says the end of the wheelbarrow tracks were. Do you know what I mean? Do you remember?
Yeah.
Just because you were like, you know, he's lying about this or he's full of shit about this, but he was in the military. So when he says it was far away, you know, he knows what he's talking about. I just wanted to push back and say, like, if I'm going to throw it out, I'm going to throw it all out. Like, I'm not going to take any of that.
That's, you know what I mean? That's fair. But to make myself clear, the point I was making was the differences between what he wrote on that day and what he testified to.
Okay.
On that day, in his report, he wrote that it was a half mile.
Okay.
And also testified to that. On that day, he wrote in his report that they documented the tracks and there's nothing about any area of disturbance. But then when he testified, then he says, oh, yeah, the tracks were going every direction and it looked like there was a big area of disturbance.
Okay.
That was, you know. So what I was doing was...
So there's a consistency in one fact that he states, and then there's an utter inconsistency in another.
Yeah.
I understand that. I didn't. Yeah. That was not my takeaway, so that makes sense.
Yeah, that was my issue with it. Was because when I'm reading his testimony, and he's talking about at the end of the tracks, at the end of the tire track, there's footprints going every way in an area of disturbed earth. I was like, what the hell? LeClaire didn't say that. Ramirez didn't say that. We have no pictures of that. Why is he saying that? So then I go back to his report to see if it's consistent with what he said back then, and that part of it was not consistent. That's what I was pointing out.
Okay.
But the half mile thing, that was his impression back then. I don't think he was full of shit when he wrote his report. Okay. I think he was full of shit when he testified Understood. Later.
That makes sense. Thanks for clarifying that for me. Quick shout out to Jackie. I know you mentioned the idea of potentially Becky screaming if she was outside. And I think we did cover that on a past follow-up. But yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that we've questioned is, you know, if she mm-hmm. makes it outside, is she able to make any sound? And would that have been heard? And that's a huge question mark for me.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just there's such a great distance between. And also keep in mind, maybe I haven't mentioned this. Sharon Coleman in the cabin, the closest cabin, wasn't home. When she came home, the fire trucks were already there.
Okay.
So the closest place
that's
for somebody,
the only thing I can think of that's even remotely close.
Yeah, if you remember being up there, you got to go across the street and then down another long ways before you get to another place.
Yeah.
So like just her screaming, and I'm really leaning towards more, and I want to have an ME look at the autopsy and crime scene photos. I'm leaning more and more towards the idea that she was suffocated or, you know, strangled in some way. There's a tricky thing because in her body you have like the frothing that you see that happens after death, oftentimes in a strangulation because of the edema that's happening in the airway and the lungs. You have that in the crime scene photos where she was found, but also there's fire, which will happen in a fire too. But usually, and when I first looked at it, I was looking at in respect to, well, they're saying that she didn't inhale any smoke, that she was dead before the fire. But you see this kind of like frothing happen when someone dies in a fire, like they die because, you know, they inhale the superheated gases and all that stuff. So it didn't add up to me until I started looking at, well, but also you see that in cases where someone is strangled. And in this case, I don't want to get into details, but you can tell that that frothing action that happened after the fire. So I'm kind of leaning that way, which I bring it up now because we're talking about the scream, as I think that a hypothesis that could be considered is that she did get out. She did try to scream and someone held her down and held their hand over her mouth and nose and basically just choked her, like, you know, suffocated her in that way. And I think that would get that kind of frothing that we have.
Okay. I want to just go back really quickly to Kate and Jennifer. Wait, was it you and Kate and Jennifer? I think so. Oh, yeah. Coming back to this shell casing, the shell casing that was next to the wheelbarrow. I know we've talked about it before, but Kate and Jennifer, I think, very reasonably are kind of wanting to circle back to that and say, again, like, we're sure that's not connected in any way. It just seemed old. Is that what?
We're not sure. The investigators thought it looked old. When I looked at it, I also thought it looked like it was old and weathered, but I'm not an expert. I don't know if it was ever really examined. So it's not something we should rule out.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things that it kind of looks old and we don't have any evidence that she was shot.
Right. So, but also, you know, Jennifer reminds us that the autopsy did, you know, say there was no indication of strangulation. I know we talked about that with,
well,
you know,
they said that
the hyoid bone
wasn't broken. But that, number one, you can strangle somebody without breaking it. Number two, suffocation is different than strangulation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, suffocate, you know, meaning holding your hand over someone's mouth and nose, stopping them from breathing until they die is different than crushing their larynx with your thumbs and cutting off their airflow that way.
Yeah. And I think we're probably remembering that because that conversation too was tied to you and Jim talking about the crime scene, and he had asked about any signs of strangulation. And so at the time, I think you were leaning more towards something happening in that abdominal region and feeling like maybe, you know, the evidence that there was no strangulation seemed more compelling to you at that time.
And in the autopsy, it does say that they don't see evidence of it because of the hyoid. My question is, could there be evidence based on the that frothing? Could that indicate that she was suffocated?
Yeah. I got to start wrapping up because I know we've been doing this for a very long time. Kim wants to know how close Christian and Becky were to each other. And again, kind of wondering about the idea of him giving her a card seems strange unless they were more connected to each other.
Yeah, they didn't know each other very. He knew her through Robert, basically.
Yeah, that whole thing is just the idea of like a teenage boy being like, I have this card for you. But I understand that's what the cards are for. So I What I'm saying is meaningless. It doesn't matter.
I have a hard time figuring out the card, whether you're looking at Robert and Christian being guilty or innocent. Like I don't understand the scenario at how it ever comes up. Even if Christian was there and he participated in these murders, what is he doing with the card? Why is it out there in the desert? How does it come out? Like, that's weird. And then, like, if it's just was just some innocuous thing from a year before.
Also super weird.
Still weird. Like, I don't know.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. Okay. Jennifer H. says, I was looking through Sexton's report from 1906, and in it he described speaking to a Steve Russell, a neighbor who didn't like the Freedleys and had a bruised and bloodshot eye. Russell said he had gotten LASIK work done on his eye. Did you see any indication the police verified his story and learn if Russell had arguments or reported problems with the Freedleys?
Russell's interviewed, and I've listened to it, and I'm going to put out some bonuses with some of those if I don't fit them in. So just to be very transparent with you, with this show coming out with Hulu, they've they've said that they may need to run me around places to do some press for it.
Big shot,
and so but point being, I'm holding that a couple of those little interviews in case I need to just throw together an episode because I'm gone. And if we get through that and that doesn't happen, then I will just use those as just, but we'll put them out as bonuses for you.
Jay, this is not a silly question at all. Jay says, do we ever see any dog prints, any paw prints anywhere? It doesn't seem like that's ever come up.
I thought not a
dumb question.
No, I thought that, and I'd have to go back through the photos, but I recall looking at one of those close-up photos and seeing what I thought was a dog print in it, but they're definitely never mentioned. And they're not like throughout, but I feel like I recall seeing one thing that looked like a dog. My mind's telling me it was like by placard A or B or something, but I don't remember.
Yeah. Okay. Caroline, and I know Caroline, you've asked this a couple times. I'm sorry I haven't gotten to it until right now, but Caroline says, when was Pompancero officially removed as the lead and LeClaire took over?
I don't know. I think it was within the first couple weeks. It's mentioned, like, they talk, but they never, even in the testimony, there's never, so on this day, they also never talk about the reason why during the testimony, and there's not, like, a piece of paper in the case file that says, on this day, if there is, I haven't seen it, Pompancero was removed as lead, and LeClaire, based on the testimony, it sounds to me like within a week or two, probably even within the first week, that LeClaire took over.
Okay, yeah, well, whenever Tiffany had that next conversation with LeClaire, she still thought that Pompancero was the lead, but she was wrong. It was then LeClaire. That's one thing that like stood out to me as a sort of crossing point, because she's like, yeah, I've been calling the main guy, not you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Real quick, Danielle in the chat, whose husband works for a phone, I think, must.
Oh, yeah. I just saw that.
Yeah. She said that the phone line info, if it was cut, a clean cut, and the wires were not crossed, then calls coming in would just ring on the caller's end. But if there was damage or a cross in the wires, that would create a busy signal. For example, if the phone lines melted, so that could just be that they melted in the fire.
Interesting.
If they melted and then were touching, shorting each other, according to Danielle's husband, that could create the busy signal.
Wow, that's so interesting. That's great to know. Kate says, are we, oh yeah, this is Kate. This is you, Kate. Yeah, I definitely have this in here. Are we going to hear the entire trial transcript like in past cases? I think that would be beneficial and give us more context to the picture the prosecution painted rather than pieces. Then we could provide input on which parts we needed to cover more in depth. And Teresa adds along the same lines, if we don't hear them read, could we still have redacted copies?
Yeah. As you said, as always, we go through the entire, like, part of this process now is the case against Robert and Christian. We're going to be going through all of the testimonies. So one, you learn how they built the case against them, and we get all that information. And then as we go through it, then they'll be posting the transcript. But yeah, we're going to go through the entire transcript, and it'll all be posted and available.
Awesome. And then I'll just finish up with Teresa, who says, going back to the stipulated episode, if something is a stipulation, does that prohibit the defense or prosecutors from referring to it? Meaning, could they say it's been stipulated that neither Robert or Christian's DNA was found on the samples found on Becky's clothing? And does the jury get a copy of the stipulations to use when deliberating?
I believe they get a copy of them. I know they're read to the jury. This is a lawyer question that we need to ask. Some of it has come up in the Facebook group from some of our lawyers, but I'm not sure about it. I believe they can get a copy of it. And I've seen parts in the transcript where they're mentioned, but they're just touched on. So when I put up like Jennifer Sniff's testimony, you don't see Moore saying, well, we've already stipulated that you ruled out Christian as being a contributor on this card. He doesn't say that. He says, we've already talked about the work you did on the case, so we're not going to talk about that. And then he moves, and then he moves on. I don't know if that was because he wasn't allowed or if he just didn't. If he just didn't, I think that was a mistake to not take the opportunity to make that point again. But I'm not sure. I'll have to get back to you, Teresa, on that when I talk to a lawyer about those rules.
Yeah, because I would have to think it would be given to the jury as like, this is part of the case. Like, make sure to read this along with everything else when you're deliberating. But
yeah.
All right. That's all I have. Sorry, I got a little hot under the collar there for a second. But yeah, everyone had been talking so much about some of the mean stuff on Facebook. They got a little fired up. It felt like I was playing an attorney. I was like, isn't it true, Your Honor?
Anyway. I think, and you know, Janet's already in the red because she's in the middle of Sketchfest. If you're around San Francisco, you can go see.
Yeah, come see some comedy shows.
That's her big show that she puts on every year, big festival. And I can't believe she takes 2 hours, 3 hours away from to chat with us every week.
I'm addicted to trying to solve this case.
Yeah. Well, let's do it. Let's keep moving forward. Thank you, Janet. Thank you, Zach. Thank you, YouTube people. You win the show today, Zach.
For sure.
And hopefully all of you listeners are winners as well. And if you haven't checked out Web of Death, apparently my episode's out yesterday, so go check it out.
Great. Can't wait.
See you next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Justice is an NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Edited by Kelly Barons Brink, and all music for the show was created by PutThemInASong.com. Our follow-up logo was created by me, and all of our font across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Kay Woodyomnik, Ginger Viola, Erica Cantor, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Ford, Courtney Wimberly, and Melissa Cardenas. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in several ways. To financially support the show, the best thing you can do is just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You'll not only be supporting the show, but you'll get something in return. On Patreon, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes bonus video content every week. Then other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also do us a huge favor by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the brands that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page on Facebook. And for all you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod. To follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found in all forms @BobRuffTruth. Janet can be found @JanetVarney. And Zach is @Z2TheQ. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. As for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
I almost nailed that one, Kelly, but I didn't. Close enough. And I also didn't maintain eye contact, like I said. I was looking away, Kelly. I'm sorry. Oh, boy. These guys pee way too much, I think. I think they need to go to the urologist, see what's happening with them as I'm just talking to you. Oh, yeah. Wait, the Patreon people are here. I probably shouldn't have said all of that to the Patreon people. I was just talking to Kelly. So Patreon people, pretend like you didn't hear me talk about their urinary problems. Okay? Between us, okay? Just between us. I appreciate you guys. And these fucking quail. I can hear these quail in here. I don't know if you guys can, if the mic picks them up, but you guys, I can hear the quail in here. And it fucking drives me nuts. I also don't know where they went. They're gone an awful long time. There's Janet. I don't know what's happening. I just keep talking. What's happening? You're on mute, Janet.